Nice. Would you like to offer this one? Yeah. Great. Otherwise, I have to just see it. I can just look at it. You know, that's not so nice. Thank you. That's really good. Okay. Okay, everyone. So let's get started. And Venerable, if you would like to say anything, please do so at any time. Jump in. If you want to add anything, you know, you're always welcome to do so. Okay, so let us continue where we left off yesterday. There's quite a few questions here, which is great. So let's see what happens. Okay, Ajahn, do I understand correctly that wisdom is needed to be around in all the factors of enlightenment? Thank you. So you are asking whether wisdom is required around all the factors, and that they are part of all the factors of enlightenment, something like that. That kind of wisdom supports all those factors. Yeah. Okay. Yes, that is true. Wisdom is always useful. Yeah. The more wisdom you have at any stage of the path, the more ability you have to deal with the problems, and you have to do the right, get the right thing. And one other thing is, later on during this retreat, I will have a look at the 37 Bodhipakya Dhammas, the 37 aids to awakening. And of those 37 factors, you have the five faculties, the five indriyas. And those five indriyas, you have the wisdom faculty at the top. And the wisdom faculty is there specifically said to support and stabilize the other four faculties. So when you have wisdom, everything else on the path tends to stabilize as a consequence. So wisdom is always the most important one of all these things. But initially, wisdom is almost like just understanding the teachings of the Buddha. The more you understand them, it's almost like as if you are taking on board the Buddha's wisdom. And by taking on board his wisdom, you are, even though initially you may not actually really have that wisdom yourself because you haven't seen it properly for yourself, you're acting it out in such a way that eventually you will get there. Yeah, so this is really what it is, how it works. So, and one of the things that is, I think, very important to realize about the way the path of meditation works is that sometimes we talk about the distinction between vipassana meditation and samatha meditation as if they are two separate types of meditation practice. Vipassana being insight, samatha being calm meditation. But really, there are just two aspects of the same thing. The way that the Buddha never talks about vipassana meditation is a modern expression that has been invented, you know, fairly recently. So it's a word that is being used to explain meditation practice. And there's nothing wrong with it as such, but it's important to understand that the Buddha just talked about meditation, bhavana, for example, anapanasati, watching the breath would be one of those. And when you practice these things, two things happen together, and that is samatha and vipassana, calm and clear seeing. I prefer clear seeing as a translation of vipassana, are the outcome. Both of those are the outcome of meditation. They always come together. You cannot really separate them. And clear seeing is very similar to wisdom. Yeah, so you can see that the more calmer you are, the deeper your samadhi is, the more wisdom you will have. Almost by default, it comes with it. It is part of it. Or rather, you have more clear seeing, and that clear seeing in turn is the foundation for wisdom. The more you see clearly, the more wisdom you tend to get. You see clearly again and again and again, and then it starts to sink in, and you become wise as a consequence of that. There's a nice little verse in the Dhammapada where the Buddha says that he says there's no jhana without wisdom. There's no wisdom without jhana. But the one who has both wisdom and jhana is in the vicinity, is close to nibbana. Yeah, so you cannot have jhana without wisdom. That's what he's saying there. So when people say, oh, you know, sometimes you hear this idea that people are just practicing samatha without vipassana and you're kind of enjoying jhanas or whatever, but it's actually impossible to have jhanas without insight or wisdom. And part of the insight you have when you practice jhanas, because you have gone beyond the sensory world, the world of the five senses, you understand the five senses. You understand their problem, their dukkha, the unsatisfactoriness of that realm, their impermanence and all of these things. So already, you actually have a lot of insight already just by attaining the five jhanas, five jhanas. Yeah, actually, there is five also. There is a category of five jhanas as well, so that wasn't really wrong, but it was still I didn't really mean to say that. So wisdom is supportive all the way, and in fact, it is part and parcel of meditation practice.
What about people that don't have any wisdom and they want to practice in order to gain wisdom?
If you want to practice, you have wisdom. Yeah, otherwise you wouldn't want to practice. The fact that you want to practice is already wisdom.
Well, yeah? not really.
Okay.
But, you know,
yeah.
When we start practicing, the wisdom may be kind of, you know, knowledge.
Yeah.
You know, basic knowledge. And once we practice more and more,
yeah,
then we gain, you know, knowledge become wisdom.
Yeah. Yeah, true. But I think also, you know, I agree with you. So in the beginning it is quite shallow. But one of the nice things the Buddha says in the Dhammapada, he says that the ignorant person who thinks they're wise, they're really ignorant. But the ignorant person who knows they're ignorant, they are wise to that extent. So already, you know, sometimes very simple things can be a degree of wisdom. And the idea that you want to practice, to me, that's already a sign that you have some understanding here. Because most people don't want to practice. They want to kind of chill out, they want to, you know, enjoy the world, their things and that kind of stuff. So I think already there is some kind of understanding. But I agree with you, it's shallow and it's not really experiential perhaps. It is kind of, it isn't very deep yet. So the depth really starts to happen later on. Yeah. So anything? Anything more?
Well, you know, for some people, if we talk about wisdom, you know, you have to live to work all the way through. What if, you know, if they think that they don't have wisdom yet, then they might be discouraged.
You put it closer to your mouth, the microphone, I think. Yeah. By the way.
You are making noise.
This is too loud. I think it's just the one at the back is trying to adjust it. That's why you got the noise. Put it closer to your mouth, otherwise you can't hear properly. Yeah. Try that. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, did you hear?
Closer to your mouth. Yeah.
I forgot what I said now.
Yeah.
No, I was saying that in case, you know, people that they don't think they have enough wisdom, that's why they want to practice, to gain wisdom.
Hmm.
What if we say that it takes, you know, wisdom to go all the way through, then they might be discouraged.
Yeah, I think it's just how you put it, yeah? And we can encourage them by saying, you're already wise. You know that you have to practice, yeah? So you tell them, you already have some degree of wisdom. That's how you encourage people. So, and it's also true. It's not just a kind of just an encouragement. It's actually a truth to it. And then you tell them that as you practice, the wisdom comes with the practice. The practice comes with the wisdom. Two pillars come together. Uh-huh. They grow together. And then I think people will kind of be encouraged by that kind of, you know, attitude, yeah. Something like that?
Well, when I start practicing, I didn't think about any wisdom or anything.
Just start. Exactly. And I think that's what happened to many people. They kind of just have a feeling this is a good thing to do. And they do that as a, you know, and then they kind of find their way as they go about these things. Okay. Okay, so let's go on to the next one. Dear Ajahn, thanks for the deathbed contemplation last year. Last year, I just did it this morning. Could we add a skillful way of ignoring the pains in our body, or rather how to separate mind and body during our deathbed? Okay. I see what you're trying to get to here. Could we add a skillful way of ignoring the pains in our body, and rather how to separate mind and body during and on our deathbed? Okay, I see what you mean here. Yes, you can. This is kind of one of the difficulties of the deathbed. Very often, people often have pains because they may have some serious illness and all of these kind of things. And this is what can make death very difficult. I just heard of somebody who had passed away in lots of pain because they died from lung cancer, I think, or something like that. And lung cancer can be very painful, apparently, especially during the dying process. But it can be very hard to separate these things, because it is maybe a little bit easier on your deathbed because you know you're dying, so you have more ability to let go of things. But even then it's difficult, just like it is difficult during meditation to kind of ignore the pain altogether. It's not going to be easy on your deathbed either. And I would recommend people take some painkillers, yeah? Use that even while you're dying. I know sometimes it is said that in Buddhism we should die without using painkillers or any kind of drugs, but I don't really agree with that, to be honest, because what happens in the dying process, and this is what is so interesting about it, that as you are dying, your mind and body are already separating. So even though you are a bit drugged out initially, the closer you get to death, the more clarity you tend to get. It's just like I was saying the other day about Alzheimer's patients. Yeah, sometimes you have Alzheimer's and you are really out of it until the very last minutes before you die. And suddenly you regain your consciousness again, your awareness, your memories and everything. Yeah. And it's the same thing with painkillers. You use painkillers as you're dying, but then towards the very end, because the mind separates from the physical body, the painkillers only work on the physical body. They've got nothing to do with the mind. So when the mind releases, your clarity comes back anyway, and then you are back where you were before, and you can continue with your mindfulness, and you can continue to do the right things. So using painkiller doesn't really stop you from having a good death. In fact, I think very often the opposite, because if you have too much pain, it can lead to, you know, maybe it can lead to delusion, or it can lead to maybe you get angry about things because pain you have means you have less patience and all kind of stuff. So I think it is better to have something which calms these things down, and that actually will be preferable during the death, as far as I'm concerned. So that's my preferred way of getting rid of pain. I don't know, using drugs, yeah, that's what most people do these days. And I don't know if you agree with that. If you don't agree with that, come back tomorrow and then tell me off and say, what? You can't say that, or whatever you want to say. So, because there are different opinions about this, but that is my take on these things.
I have, my personal experience, when I had a toothache, went very bad. And at night, you know, very painful. And some teachers in Thailand, they teach, to meditate, to separate nama and rupa. So I tried that. It worked. You know, I didn't feel, you know, the pain. I could sleep all night.
Yeah.
Just, you know, meditate on that pain and separate the pain and the gum, you know, nama, rupa.
Mind-body separation, yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And it worked, and I slept through. Otherwise, it was very painful.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Yeah, excellent. So that may work, but there is no guarantee it will work every time. It may not work straight away. It may take a while before it works. It's hard to know exactly how, and it's hard, you know, to control it can be very, very difficult.
But you could still feel the pain, but not cruciate kind of pain. Otherwise, you know, it would be very appreciate.
Yeah, yeah.
Very
okay, good. Yeah. So how do you do that? You want to give some instructions?
Well, I just, you know, mindful of the pain.
Yeah.
And then, you know, by a very strong mindfulness on that pain, and eventually it will just separate the pain and it come.
Mm.
You just, you know, have to be really very strong concentration on it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Good. Yeah. Okay.
I just tried. I never did try before, but I heard, you know, they separate nama rupa.
Mm.
You know, the pain if and
nama rupa parichedo jnana, one of the jnanas in the Visuddhi Magga. That's what it refers to usually. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So I just tried it, but it, you know, it seemed to work.
Yeah. Pretty good. Okay. Yeah. Good. Yeah. So if you have no painkillers, then use this other method. Yeah. Focus on it.
No, the painkiller didn't work.
Didn't work?
Yeah, I took the pill, but it didn't work.
Okay.
It was very crucial.
Yeah, okay. Well, that's another good reason then to use that method here. Okay, thank you, Venerable. Yeah. Yeah. Let us move on to the next one now. Dear Ajahn, aren't there three types of Buddha? Samma, Sambuddha, Pacheka Buddha, and the one who achieves enlightenment by listening to the Dhamma. Doesn't Buddha mean the awakened one? Three types of Buddha. There are three types of awakened beings, perhaps. Samma Sambuddha, which is the Buddha in the suttas, and also other Buddhas that arise every now and again. Pacheka Buddha, individual Buddha, private Buddha, the Buddha who awakens to the truth also on their own, but who don't have any disciples. They just live on, they just relax and chill and don't really teach anyone. That's kind of nice, isn't it? And the one who achieves enlightenment by listening to the Dhamma, that's kind of the arahant, yeah? The one who is the disciple of a Buddha. Huh? Doesn't Buddha mean the awakened one? It does. That's what it means. So all of these three are awakened, and they have all achieved the same level of awakening. The difference is only their whether they are the first one or whether they have disciples and this kind of thing. That's really the only difference to these things. They're not normally called three types of Buddhas. Usually they're usually called Samma Sambuddha, Pacheka Buddha, and Arahant is usually what they are called. So, yes. And as I mentioned early on, the word Buddha is still used in certain of the Indo-European languages. And it means like to wake up. So you wake up in the morning, then you are Buddha. That's quite easy, isn't it? That's the easy way to be Buddha. Just wake up in the morning, yeah. Bang, you're Buddha. But that's the fourth kind of Buddha, yeah? It doesn't count. Doesn't count on this list. Okay. Are you happy with that? So, if you're not happy with my replies, please just write again and we'll see what happens tomorrow. Dear Ajahn, when we see a bright nimitta in the meditation, do we still continue watching the breath like normal? Thank you. If you see a really bright nimitta in your meditation that is quite stable and it is, you know, it is not just fluctuating or there's a danger that it will disappear quickly, you can shift your attention from the breath to that nimitta. And that nimitta is what then will take you all the way into jhana if you practice it appropriately. Yeah. Keep your attention on that and it will take you all the way in. But you have to be careful because nimittas can be very fragile. Yeah, they can be unstable or not very powerful, not very strong. And when they are not, and when you shift your attention, they may disappear. So there may be a point when you can use both at the same time. You both have the breath and you also have the visual nimitta at the same time. And you kind of work them together. And then the nimitta brightens up and eventually you let go of the breath completely. The breath may even still be there, but kind of very faint in the background. And then the nimitta becomes the main object. So you kind of gradually move across from one to the other. Sometimes you need to experiment a little bit to find out for yourself what works. A lot of meditation and overcoming hindrances and making progress really should be based on your own experience. You do these things and then you learn how these things work. because we're all slightly different, and what one person says may not kind of be how you experience things in your life and in your meditation practice. So a lot of it is has to be your own personal experience dealing with these things, and then finding ways through it, and then moving on. That's how I see it.
Can we go straight to jhana without nimitta?
This is a kind of one of those old questions. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think it's very difficult to say. To me, the people I know who have jhana's experiences, and who I feel I fairly certain have some really good experiences with meditation, I think most of them, maybe all of them, went through a nimitta stage. So I think it is very likely to be required. So I'm not sure about that. What do you think?
I don't know. Sometimes, nimitta doesn't take all the way to jhana, just stay there. But sometimes, it seems like I can just go straight through, but I don't know if jhana or not, but but it seems like, you just go straight up.
Yeah.
I think you can.
You think you can? Okay. Okay. Yeah, uncertain. Certainly, the standard way that is described in most places is going through the nimitta. If you look at the sutta like the Upakilesa Sutta that we had looked at before, which was the sutta where the Buddha goes out and he talks to Anuruddha, Kimbila, and Nandiya, and then he asks them, "Have you attained any Uttarimanusa Dhammas, any superhuman qualities?" And they say, "We see lights and visions of forms." Remember that, those of you who were here at the beginning for the life of the Buddha, and that those lights and visions of forms, they are basically what we call nimittas in meditation. And then the Buddha tells you how to deal with those nimittas, how to deal with the defilements that are there, still there with those nimittas, and then how to overcome those defilements so that you go into the jhanas. The process you see there is exactly that. You see the lights, forms and lights come together, the overcoming of the refined hindrances that are still there, and then the jhanas, which is pretty much what you would expect if when nimittas are part of the path. Okay.
Only light nimitta?
That is the one. The visual nimitta is the one I'm talking about. Yeah.
Only the light.
I think so. Yes. Yes. No. Maybe. Okay.
Because there are different nimittas, right? But, light is one of them.
Yeah. Yes, that they are. But I think there's something that happens when the mind, because the mind becomes very bright, yeah, and it tends to see. Maybe some minds work differently, but you tend to experience the world visually. It's a very important part of how we experience the world. So I suspect that when the mind becomes very beautiful, that's probably how we tend to understand the mind. I don't know if it is absolutely required, but I think it is it's a kind of natural thing. So I don't know the answer to that. But what I do know is that this is what the majority of people do. And I know that many people who don't have light nimittas and they think they have jhanas, they haven't actually got it. There's something less. So in my experience, it's a bit dangerous to move into other areas, because very often you will misinterpret those experiences as jhanas, when in fact they're not actually the full samadhi yet.
Well, when you see the light nimitta, where do you see it?
Well, you see it in your mind's eye, yeah. It's just there. You see it, yeah.
Any part of the body?
I think most people see it as if you see it here or something, pretty much in front of your eyes, where you would kind of normally see things, not too far away. But it varies, and the kind of the type of nimitta will vary. If you read the Visuddhimagga, you can have all kinds of strange nimittas according to the Visuddhimagga, and I think that might be the case. It might depend on the person, and the colors may even vary. There may be all kinds of things. So again, I don't know the answer to that. I think people different people have probably slightly different experiences.
Not for you, you yourself.
Yeah, I don't want to go into too much into that. But yeah. Anyway, yes?
Because I see different parts, you know, sometimes forehead.
Yeah.
Sometimes, you know, the middle.
Okay.
Chest, sometimes it's just the eyes, you know.
Okay.
In the area.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, my experience, what I think is that most people, they have a kind of usual place where the nimitta arises. Tends to be kind of one particular place. But perhaps that too is different for different people. Not sure. Yeah. That's what you do with it. You stay with it. Yeah, this is what we were talking about the other day. We were looking at the Anapanasati Sutta. Remember that the third stage of Anapanasati, the third tetrad, is where you have the citta pratisangvedi, you experience the mind, yeah? That is the nimitta, and the next one is you gladden the mind, abhipamojayang chittang, and you have the samadahang chittang, which is like stilling the mind, and the last one is vimochayang chittang, which is the releasing the mind. So what you do is just stay with it, and as you do that, it becomes more happy, it becomes more bright, yeah? And then and eventually it takes you all the way into the jhana states, that is vimochayang chittang, where it's liberated. So you just stay with it, just like the breath. You don't do anything with the breath, you just allow the breath to develop as you stay with it. And this is really what this is about. So it's very pleasant, very simple, nothing really you need to do, which is kind of nice. You just relax, enjoy the ride, you know? That's what it is about. Then it disappears. Sure, of course it disappears. Yeah, it's not stable, it may go, just like the breath sometimes, you may enjoy it for a while and then it disappears again. Okay, let's go on to the next one. Hi Arjana, where is the best place to start if we're just starting out learning the suttas? Thank you. This is a standard question, and what I would recommend you to do is to start by reading a book by Bhikkhu Bodhi, an anthology of the suttas called In the Buddha's Words. It is very nice because it is grouped according to various subjects. So it starts off with a simple subject like sila and parents and generosity and all of that in the Buddha's words. And then also has introductory passages that introduce each section. It explains to you what it is about. It has footnotes at the end which explains again what is going on. And then you have Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi's translations, which are quite good. Sometimes a little bit academic, I feel, because he has a PhD in philosophy, and then when you have a PhD in philosophy, it tends to affect how you write, unfortunately. So I sometimes prefer Ajahn Sujato's translations, because he has deliberately used a kind of more common, ordinary language, rather than make it highfalutin and whatever. It's a more common, ordinary language, which actually reads really nicely. When I read those sutta translations, I think they're actually really nice. So start with that one. It's a good way to start. If you find it hard to understand certain suttas, lots of suttas are available online, explained, yeah? A little bit like I explain here now. They are available from myself. Ajahn Brahm does sutta explanations online. Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi does sutta explanations online. You can find sutta explanations by Ajahn Sujato and by a large number of people who do these kind of things. One of the Malaysian monks, Venerable Dhamma Buddha, Bhikkhu Hai, who has his monastery up in Ipoh, he does sutta explanations online. There's lots of people who do this. And of course, sometimes it will be contradictory. Yeah, you listen to one, it's not, why, who is right? You say things different way. But what you find, even if there are contradictions occasionally, you find many of the main themes will be the same. Yeah? A lot of it will be the same, and there will be occasional distinctions and differences. And one of the differences will be that some people will rely more on the commentaries and the Abhidhamma and Visuddhimagga in the interpretation, whereas I sometimes do that as well, but I try to rely more on the suttas and cross-referencing and that kind of thing instead. So that for this reason, there will be slight differences. And then, once you have done that, and you have got a good idea of the essentials, then if I were you, I would go to the Majjhima Nikaya, the middle length sayings of the Buddha, Because they are very beautiful, they are very complete suttas, and they kind of give a complete teaching. If you go to the numerical discourses or the connected discourse, they're often very short, and you don't really feel you get a complete discourse by the Buddha. But imagine it's a complete discourse, and you have the setting, you know, the Buddha was staying in a certain place, and then a certain monk, or occasionally a nun, or the lay people come and they ask for a teaching, and then you kind of have a whole little bit of a story around it, and it creates a setting, it creates more of a feeling of being part of the what happened in India 2,500 years ago. You are kind of part of the audience in a sense. So those suttas are really nice. The disadvantage with the Majjhima Nikaya is that the very first sutta is the most profound sutta in the entire Pali Canon probably. So most people come to the first sutta and then they give up on reading suttas ever after because they started off with the most difficult one. So, and this is one of the tricks about reading suttas is that if you don't enjoy a particular sutta, don't read it. Skip it. Go to the next one. Go to find one that you actually enjoy, one that speaks to you, one that you feel, yeah, I can learn something from this one. One that has some beautiful similes in it, some nice metaphors. And one of my favorite suttas, and this is, I think, for many, is a nice sutta, is the Chula Hati Padopama Sutta, the shorter discourse on the elephant's footprint, Majjhima Nikaya 27. That was a sutta that was taken to Sri Lanka by Mahinda. Mahinda was Emperor Ashoka's son. He became a monk, and he was the one who started Buddhism in Sri Lanka, according to the story. And one of the suttas that he taught when he got to Sri Lanka was this particular sutta. And that is what kind of turned Sri Lanka around and made Sri Lanka a Buddhist. The king was there, the queen was there, and they all became Buddhist, yeah? And then you had a Buddhist country after that. That's the story. I'm not sure if it was quite that simple, but that's kind of the story. Yeah? So this was one of the... And it's a very beautiful sutta. And it is a sutta on the gradual training, the whole training from the beginning to the very end. And it's the kind of sutta that I often use when I teach meditation retreats because it gives a beautiful sequence on how to do the practice. So something like that. And then you can read some of the more inspiring parts of the Pali Canon, like the Dhammapada. So you can have the Dhammapada on your little night table next to your bed. And before you go to sleep, yeah, quickly read one verse before you fall asleep. Otherwise, sometimes you read the suttas, oh, you fall asleep because it's so boring. But the good thing about the Dhammapada is that short verses, you don't really have time to fall asleep until the verse comes to an end. Yeah, that's kind of the nice thing about it. So you read one verse, and sometimes when you read something profound from the Buddha, something which is beautiful, and maybe if it has been translated in a nice way, so it sounds like a verse or whatever, you feel kind of inspired and uplifted, and it's a great way of falling to sleep. So even if you don't do any metta meditation before you go to bed, this already can lift you up a little bit. So this is my the way I look at this. Okay, let's go on to the next one. If you want to say something available, just please interfere at any time. And just I don't mean interfere, just jump in at any time. Next one. Can a person become enlightened even while they're still alive? Absolutely. Certainly you can't. Otherwise, if it only happens after you're dead, then it's not the same thing. Yeah. Otherwise, we wouldn't have a Buddha. That's kind of the point of the Buddha. How do we know we're enlightened? Do they know it themselves? Thank you, Sadhu times three. Okay. Absolutely, while you're still alive, because that's what the Buddha is. The Buddha was alive and he was enlightened, and some of his main disciples too were arahants, yeah, so they were alive and they were enlightened. Is that what you mean, or do you mean while you're still a lay person perhaps? Is that what you mean perhaps? I'm not sure exactly what you... Yeah? Anyway, so how do you know you're enlightened? You know if you're enlightened, yeah? It says in the suttas that you know that the job has been done, the work has been carried out, there is no more rebirth. You actually know that there is no more rebirth. Yeah, you can see that the seed of rebirth, the kina bija, the bija is a seed. Kina bija is from the Ratana Sutta. Kina bija, the seed has been ended, destroyed. There's no more seed there to actually give rise to future rebirth. So you know, guaranteed, if you are arahant, there's no doubt. If you ask, am I an arahant? you're not an Arahant. Yeah, this is one of the ways of knowing that you're not an Arahant. So that's a very useful way. Stream entry is a bit more subtle, but if you have doubts, if you don't think you're a stream enterer, you're not a stream enterer. But you might think that you have got further, yeah? Because stream entry is one of those very, very powerful experiences. It's a revolution in your consciousness. The world is pretty much turned upside down. So it's a very, very powerful experience. You know something amazing has happened, but you're not maybe sure exactly what. So the answer is yes, you know that you are enlightened. Okay. Next one. Dear Ajahn, can we make peace, be gentle and be kind by watching and staring at the plants and trees, nature, instead of closing our eyes as part of our meditation every day? Thank you, Sadhu with Anjali. In a sense, you can. Yeah, this is one of the reasons why staying in nature is very useful, and why the monks often would stay in nature, and why going on retreats is good to kind of get out of the city, because nature is naturally calming. And even if you don't stare at the plants and the trees, even if you just kind of go walking a little bit, you know, back and forth or whatever, already it is much more peaceful than being in the city. The answer is yes. Staring at the plants, can you do that? You can probably try, see what happens. Yeah, and if you might find that useful. But there probably comes a time when you want to close your eyes, because one of the things about samadhi and the peace of the mind is that the sensory input becomes kind of, after a while, you don't want to have the sensory input, because the sensory input is a disturbance. So this is the problem. This is one of the reasons why we close our eyes, to reduce the disturbance from the outside. And it's strange, if you close your eyes, I don't know about you, but it's already a little bit peaceful, because there is so much input coming in through the eyes. It kind of feels nice sometimes just to close your eyes and shut the world off because of all that thing coming in. So try these things out, yeah? There's nothing really wrong or right about these things. You can whatever kind of helps you, and the way that you know something is okay is if it actually makes you feel more peaceful and makes you feel better. Yeah, that you always measure it by its effect. In Buddhism, nothing is measured by being absolutely right or absolutely wrong. It is measured by its effect. And the effect should really be a long-term improvement, not just a short-term thing, but a long-term change is really what we are looking for. Of course, it has to be short-term as well if you're meditating, but it must work over a long period of time. Just experiment a little bit and see what happens. And then you may find not an entirely new way, but you may find your own little kind of path through this. Okay. Could you guide us in the 16 steps of Anapanasati? Thank you. You cannot really do this as a meditation, because these steps are very profound. So what you can do, you can guide you until the point maybe where you are watching the breath. But after that, you're pretty much on your own. Yeah. And the reason for that is because once you watch the breath, basically all you have to do is just relax and be with the breath. And then kind of in the back of your mind somewhere, you know what the 16 steps are. You know you're supposed to experience joy and happiness, this comes eventually. But don't think about these things, because if you think about them, if you expect them to happen, they won't happen. So you just have the knowledge, because you've been here. You've listened to the Anapanasati, so does you know what is going on? It's stored there somewhere way back. You don't think about it. But then when these things happen, you know that you're on the right track. So the guiding of meditation should really only be the guiding of the basics, so that you get to the point where you are kind of more independent, you can take off. The hardest part is the beginning. The difficult part is to get to the point where you're able to just be aware and stay with something. Yeah, this is actually the hardest part. Once you get to the point where you can stay with something, then the mind usually stays with it, at least for a while, until it gets bored and tired or whatever, and then it comes out again. There's like a cycle, usually, you come out again after a while. For that reason, I guess the answer is no, I suppose. I cannot really guide you in the 16 steps of Anapanasati. You're going to have, you know, just to feel those out for yourself as you go along. Okay. If someone perpetually feels uncomfortable or like a misfit in the culture where they're born, is it possible that they could have been from another culture in their previous lives? Just curious. Thank you. Sadhu times three. If you feel perpetually uncomfortable, like a misfit in the culture where you're born, maybe it's a possibility, but there are lots of people who feel like misfits in the world. Yeah, everyone feels like a misfit sometimes, and you wonder whether these beings around you are all aliens or whether you are of the same species sometimes. You know what it's like. Sometimes you can't really find it hard to communicate with the people around you or whatever. A lot of people feel like this. And one possibility is that indeed you were part of another culture in the past. That is one possibility. But one of the things that I discover, the more you look at human beings and you look at their psychology and what people really want in life and what makes people happy, people are basically the same. Cultural differences are very superficial, and it's just the thin kind of layer on top. But really, we want the same things in life. We want to be happy. We want to avoid problems and difficulties in life. We want to be content and find real meaning. We're all basically the same, and we even tend to go about it pretty much the same way. Everyone has families, everyone works, everyone the food tastes slightly different in one culture from another one, but that's kind of, who cares, it's such a small thing. That was a nice saying by one of the very famous teachers in Thailand, Ajahn Tate. Have you heard about Ajahn Tate? Very famous Thai teacher in Thailand. And he said, what's the point of traveling around the world and seeing all these various cultures? They're just basically the same thing. It's still the five senses. The same thing, slight variations on the theme. There's no difference. And like Ajahn Brahm says, we're in our monastery, and he says to all the monks, why do you want to go to see the wall of China? Just go up and see the wall of Bodhidharma Monastery. Yeah, it's much closer. It's only kind of just go up to the road, and it's a road. And this is kind of the thing. Yeah, it is not, okay, the wall of China is a bit more impressive than the wall of Bodhidharma Monastery. Yeah. A lot more impressive. But it's still, okay, so it's a wall, so you see it, and then what? It's not such a big deal. But if you get some real contentment and happiness and meditation, that's where that's what it's really about. And that's where you kind of, see the big differences. So the external world is just variations on the theme, regardless of which culture you're in, regardless of where you are. Look more deeply at people, and you see so much similarity and so much that we have in common. And the nice thing about that is also that you take away some of the barriers between people. If you see the commonality between people or even other beings, you take away some of the barriers that keep us from being able to cooperate properly and all of that kind of stuff. Maybe, but maybe not. Who knows what the answer is to that question here. So that is the answer. That is the real answer. Meditate to see your past life. Then you will know. But are you sure it's the past life? What if you have a past life experience? How can you know it's your past life experience, not just a kind of an idea or your kind of a idea or nimitta or something like that happening in your mind, kind of like a video playing in your mind? How do you know it's your past life? Now Anyway, so it's a very important question, because a lot of people claim to have seen their past lives, and in fact, very often they haven't. They have just seen some kind of mental image that has been made up in their mind, and actually got nothing to do with their past life. So that ability to distinguish between what is created by the mind and what is really, a real, truthful thing, actually takes quite a bit of skill. Okay. So I hope you're okay with that, and if not, then I am afraid that is all we have to say on the matter here. Dear Ajahn, what is the difference between mindfulness and awareness? Mindfulness and awareness, they are two English words that mean pretty much the same thing. Yeah, there isn't that much difference between them, to be honest with you. And sometimes I wish that we perhaps use awareness rather than mindfulness, because I think awareness is a more better understood word than mindfulness. But I think one of the reasons why we use the word mindfulness is because in the suttas, word sati has this double meaning that we talked about before. It means both, on the one hand it means memory, on the other hand it means the ability to be aware of what's happening around you right now. And those two meanings are captured in a sense by the idea of mindfulness. When you say be mindful in English, be mindful of this, it means like remember it, yeah? Don't forget about it. So mindfulness has kind of, I think that's why this word was actually coined by, invented if you like, by an English translator, one of the earliest one called Rhys Davids. And he was the one who started the Pali Text Society, who started to publish the Pali books in Roman script, so we can read them in ordinary Latin letters. So he was the one who started with that, and he did the translations, and he used the word mindfulness to translate sati. He was the first one to do that. And that was quite a stroke of genius. Some of these early translators were quite good, actually. They had some real insights into the Buddhist teachings. Rhys Davids was his name. He died in the 1920s, a long time ago.
American writer, he translated as mindfulness as awareness with attention.
Awareness with attention.
Yes.
Okay. So that means awareness while attending to one particular thing. Is that what it means?
Awareness plus
attention.
Attention.
Okay. So the attention part, how is that different from awareness? Because you are looking at a specific thing, is that why?
Well, sometimes, that's what I think. We might be aware of something, but not specifically. Mm. But with the attention, we more focus on what we are aware of.
Yeah, so it's like the four areas of mindfulness, the four satipatthanas, right. The four areas. You attend to one of those four. Yeah.
That's what I think.
Mm. Okay. Yeah. But so to a large part, they mean the same thing. And in meditation practice, awareness is actually a very good word, because that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to be aware of what is happening here. So it's actually very useful. But, one of the important things with meditation, one of the, I think, areas where people sometimes go wrong is the idea that we should just be aware. And if as long as you are just aware, then there is no problem. But it's not really enough just to be aware. You have to know also why you are aware. You have to know whether what you're doing with the awareness is suitable, whether it's conducive to the purpose. And this is what is called sampajanya in Pali language. Sampajanya is like a wisdom faculty coming with the awareness. So you are, for example, in daily life, you're aware of doing, maybe you are kind of, I don't know what you're doing, cooking or something like that. So you're cooking. And then maybe you remember something, you get a bit upset about something. Yeah, upset. But it's not just about being aware of the fact that you're being upset, but it's about doing something to overcome the upset. And that is the sampajanya. The sampajanya tells you, this is inappropriate. I'm thinking the wrong thing. Yeah, and there are many subtle things that may be inappropriate. And so sampajanya is quite a broad field of understanding what is right and what is wrong. So these two things have to come together, sati sampajanya, and they often come together in the suttas as a kind of two things that work in harmony, should ideally work in harmony with each other. So there's a wisdom faculty with sati. Pure sati, just being aware of what you're doing, is not all that useful, in my opinion. So you have to be aware and knowing whether this is appropriate or not, whether it will lead you on the path, or whether it will lead you kind of backsliding here and going away here. Yeah, clear comprehension is one translation for sampajanya. Another one is just full, they call it full awareness sometimes. Yeah, so awareness with wisdom, awareness with the purpose and an aim to it. Okay, dear Ajahn, is the phenomenon of expansion and heaviness of one's body known as rapture during meditation? Expansion versus heaviness of one's body, known as rapture. Rapture is felt usually like almost like an energy in the body. Yeah, like a kind of energy, a very, very pleasant kind of energy, and it can kind of course through the body. Sometimes doesn't have to be in the body; can also be in the mind. It can be felt in kind of in various ways. The Visuddhi Magga is usually the place to go. It explains various kinds of piti, but it is like the gladness and uplift inside, where you feel light, you feel buoyant, you feel good. Yeah, the body is energetic and all these kind of things. Expansion and heaviness. You don't usually feel heavy. Usually with piti, usually. Rapture usually doesn't feel heavy. You start to feel more light rather than heavy, if anything. Yeah. But a lot of these things that people feel in meditation practice, whether it's expansion or contraction or heaviness and all these kind of things, these are tricks of the mind. Yeah, the mind is playing around with you. The mind is doing things because, I don't know, this is what minds do. They tend to be creative, yeah, and they create stuff. And especially when the mind becomes a little bit peaceful, the energy arises, and because the energy arises in the mind, it becomes more creative as a consequence. So expect things to happen. Expect to feel weird things, the body expanding, you know, all kind of stuff. So many people feel these things. You may not, maybe you are an exception, but it's very common for these things to happen. So don't worry too much about those things, just allow them to be. Just stay with the breath, yeah? And then these things will, eventually they will disappear, or they will transform, and different things will happen. But you kind of pass through them, and they become kind of irrelevant after a while. It's like the mind sometimes has maybe built-in tensions, or built-in things that it needs to get rid of. And this happens sometimes through these kind of visions or perceptions that you have, perceptions arising inside. So just enjoy the ride. Yeah, it's a bit of entertainment sometimes. Yeah, you see things, the body doing things. There's famously Ajahn Chah, the famous story with Ajahn Chah, where he had one of these, they call them nimittas usually in Thai Buddhism, where you see things that are strange. And he had this nimitta of his body exploding. I don't know if you heard about that. You may have heard about it. His body exploded, and all his intestines, all the inner things in his body, kind of flew out, and they hung from the branches of the trees. So he had his guts hanging over there. His heart was over there. His lungs were hanging from that tree. You know, kind of all hanging all over the place. So that would be a bit concerning if that happened, wouldn't it? How would you feel about that if that happened? Why, did it really happen or not? And that's when you realize that these things are perceptions of the mind. They don't necessarily, these are nothing to do with reality very often. So this is kind of what happens. The mind is kind of tuned into something for some reason. One of the classic examples that Ajahn Brahm tells, this must have happened to him a long, long time ago, one of his stories, when he was doing meditation, and he saw some kind of demon in his meditation. You may have heard about this before. And this demon was like one of these Tibetan demons, yeah, with kind of big fangs, blood. Have you seen those Tibetan guardians with big fangs, blood coming down, and kind of they look really scary? They're supposed to be guardians, but they look really scary guardians. And he saw one of these demons, but he knew this is a creation of the mind. And because it's a creation of the mind, I can do whatever I want with it, yeah? So he always said he put a bit funny straw hat on its head, yeah? He blacked out one of his teeth to make it look like some kind of funny, and he put a, what is it, there's a straw in his mouth, I think. Some sunglasses on it or whatever. I can't remember what it did. He kind of played around with it because he knew he had power over it. If your mind makes it, you have power over these things, yeah? And that's kind of the fun part of it. So I only think it happened once in his entire life that this happened. But if it ever happens to you, you know you have full control if you want to. That's the mind creating these things. So all of these things happen, yeah, and this is the thing about meditation and the sanya perceptions arising and coming is part of the process. Don't worry too much about it. If you are having fun and a good time, you can kind of stay with it for a while, and then you come back to the breath again, come back to the nimitta or whatever it is, and then carry on with the meditation. That is the main part. You can leave those visual things in the background and make the breath the main object of your attention. That's what really matters. Okay, last question for today. So we have kind of caught up with the ones that were left from yesterday. Dear Ajahn, when anger arises, is it skillful to say this to oneself, as it is difficult in the beginning? Let's angry at him 300 years later. What do you mean by that? You mean like, let me be angry in 300 years' time? Is that what you're saying here? When anger arises, is it skillful to say this to ourselves, as it is difficult in the beginning? Let angry at him three. Don't know if that's a good idea. Is that a good idea? It means that you can be angry at another time or something. What I meant? Okay, not now. Okay, a bit later. Okay. Okay. Yeah. Sure. Why not? If it works. Yeah. The main point is to get rid of anger now, but it's not usually the way that the Buddha recommends to do it. The way the Buddha recommends is never to be angry at all. Not in 300 years' time. Not in 1,000 years' time. Not in the past. Not in the future. Not in the present. So ideally, is to overcome the anger in a skillful way, by looking at the person in a different way. And it's surprising how relatively easy that actually is. Anger is not that hard to overcome. You have to do it consistently, you have to practice, you have to train. But everyone is capable of overcoming anger and upset in their life. It's just a matter of how we look at other people. And I will talk about this tomorrow morning, because this is the next sutta. It's all about how to overcome anger. I talk about this sutta on every retreat I do. I probably talked about this sutta 30 times before. But it's actually a very nice sutta, and I like to be reminded myself, because sometimes I get upset with people myself, and I think, jeepers, I'm still so stupid. I've been a monk for 25 years, I still fall into these mistakes. I need to remind myself as well. So it's a good one. So tomorrow, come tomorrow morning, yeah, if you have this question, don't miss out tomorrow morning. If you have work, cancel your work tomorrow and come to this class tomorrow. And then we'll talk about this. It's a very nice, one of the nice things about this sutta, it has lots of nice similes in it on how to overcome anger. And we're going to explain those in detail. Would you like to add anything more, Venerable? Sure? Absolutely sure? Okay. Okay. Nothing. Would anyone else like to say anything before we call it a night? Yes, please.
For taking everyone's precious time. Okay, so I'm so sorry. Please forgive me.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, no, I don't think you have anything to be sorry about. Sometimes it's good to be able to talk and to be able to say things. Otherwise, it becomes... Sometimes there are things that you want to share because it's important to you. And I thought your stories were very interesting, actually. I thought it was very, very interesting what you saw and the things you heard about. So I don't think you have anything to be sorry about. I think it was an addition to what we were doing already. So no worries. Okay, so please keep on enjoying yourself. And before I leave, let me pay respect to the Buddha last of all.